Fasten your seatbelt and turn up the radio. We're going on a road trip. I'm Glenn Moberg, and this is the Route 51 Year-End Review Show for the year 2014, a year of fascinating people, interesting places, provocative politics, and live performances, including bluesman Paul Filipowicz in Wausau for the Great Northern Blues Society's Blues in the Schools program, and sitting in with me in our Wisconsin Public Radio studios. Bluesman Paul Filipowicz was just one of the live musical performances you heard this year on Route 51. Later in the show, we'll be hearing from Michael Perry of Tent Show Radio, from the surviving members of the Sid Kyler Dixieland Jazz Band, and from the South Beach Chamber Ensemble. But first, let's revisit some of the great interviews you heard on the show. Let's look back at the top news stories of 2014, and we will especially look at the politics.
Please bring her on home to me. Oh, yeah.
This was a year in which Scott Walker won his third election in 4 years as governor of Wisconsin, defeating Democrat Mary Burke and bringing with him sweeping new conservative majorities in the state assembly and the state senate. Wisconsin Public Radio was in the thick of it as we hosted a series of candidate debates with our media partners, the Wausau Daily Herald, WAOW-TV9, WSAW-TV7, and the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service. Three of these high-profile debates took place back-to-back-to-back on three consecutive nights in late October, starting with the 29th State Senate race between incumbent Republican Jerry Petruski and his challenger, Paul DeMaine. The two sparred over the proposal to build an iron ore mine in the Pinoki Hills near Lake Superior.
It's under the oversight of the EPA, the Army Corps of Engineers, and the Wisconsin DNR. And if that mine cannot be built and run safely, then it should not happen. And I believe it can. We've been mining in this country for a long time, in this state for a long time, and I believe that we can have a mine that will produce jobs, that will produce commerce, and one that we really will benefit the whole state.
Paul DeMaine, you have 90 seconds.
Yes, this is one of the issues that got me into considering running for office, because I thought the process, or the lack of the process, is one of the most disrespectful, distasteful processes that I've ever seen, in which the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers wasn't even invited to the hearings on the bill, in which tribal chairmen and elected leaders were told they had 2 minutes to speak, and when little egg ringer went off, were shooed off the stand because it was almost like things were predestined.
Republican Jerry Petruski went on to defeat Democrat Paul DeMaine in the general election. DeMaine says he may run again. Also in late October, Wisconsin Public Radio and our media partners hosted a debate at UW-Stevens Point for the third congressional district candidates, incumbent Democrat Ron Kind and his Republican challenger Tony Kurtz. The question was about ISIS and homegrown terrorist attacks. Kurtz became frustrated when Kind linked the issue to education.
And right now we've got a state and decisions coming out of Madison that's drastically cutting the education budget, driving students deeper into debt. Typical undergraduates looking at about $28,000.
Congressman, let's talk about ISIS. Let's not talk about the education program here in Wisconsin.
Well,
because the beheading in Oklahoma was not a student from Wisconsin. The individual that killed the Canadian soldier in Iraq in Canada was not a Wisconsin student. So let's stay focused on what the issue is.
I thought we were talking about the radicalization of individuals and what we can do to prevent that so they're not conducting terrorist
operations. But you're talking about Wisconsin schools now.
But anyway, I think it's an important topic because we are on this university campus and we are talking about the future of this regional economy, our state, and our country. And more needs to be focused on good educational opportunities. I offered a five-point plan earlier this year in order to reduce student debt and make it easier for kids to go on to school, something that I had to do by taking out student loans and Pell Grants.
Ladies and gentlemen, I really don't know what ISIS sympathizers have to do with Pell Grants.
Incumbent Democrat Ron Kind went on to defeat Republican Tony Kurtz in the general election. We were in Wausau for the 7th Congressional District debate, the only one scheduled between incumbent Republican Sean Duffy and his Democratic challenger, Kelly Westland. The sparks flew because of the way panelist Rob Mentzer of the Daily Herald phrased a question about climate change.
What is the right response to the scientific fact of global warming?
And we start with Sean Duffy, 90 seconds, followed by Kelly Westland.
Can you clarify, would you say this was the coldest
year?
The warmest year.
This is the hottest year.
Okay. Last winter seemed awfully cold. But I'll leave that alone.
That's true in our part of the world, but that is not true.
I know what you're asking about. Listen, I think it's important that we have a common sense approach to our environment. I think a lot of us live in this area because we like the outdoors. We like to hunt and fish and ski and boat. And it's important that we take care of it. And we have common sense ideas that preserve our environment, not just for all of us to use, but for future generations. And being responsible is key. But I think it's also important to have common sense policies that match up care for the environment, but also allow us to compete and have economic growth in our area.
And Kelly Westland, you have 90 seconds.
You know, I know that there is a balancing act between protecting the environment, reducing our carbon emissions, and making sure that we protect our economic sectors. But the fact is that we live in a limited biosphere. And you're right, there are very real challenges coming at us. This is an opportunity. This is an opportunity to innovate, to address some of our biggest energy concerns. And really, when you think about the cost of energy, the most cost-effective energy form that we have is the energy that we don't waste. Why not put people to work weatherizing our homes, making our power grid more efficient?
The Wausau Daily Herald endorsed incumbent Republican Sean Duffy, who went on to defeat Democrat Kelly Westland in the general election. 2 days later, we discussed the climate change question on Route 51 with our debate panelists Rob Mentzer, Jeff Talen, and Paige Halsey.
It's offensive to be so flip as to say, well, but it was cold last winter. The issue is very serious, and it deserves to be treated seriously. Now, that's not to say that there isn't an actual balance to be struck. There is a hard balance. The fact is that people do need jobs today.
Jeff Talen?
It was interesting. I was sitting at the end of the table, and that question rings because when you asked it, you put in the scientific fact of climate change, of global warming. You could, and maybe you guys couldn't hear it, but I could at the end of the table, hear the murmur coming from, coming from the Duffy half of the audience that night, simply not believing it. And then him giving that answer, which was clearly geared toward that part of his base that simply doesn't believe it's happening.
The issue of climate change and renewable energy was part of a freewheeling Route 51 show with two freshman members of the assembly who easily won their seats, Republican Bob Culp and Democrat Katrina Shankland.
We spend $12 billion every year out of state on energy that we import. Wisconsin really needs to look at energy independence and move toward it rather than away from it as we keep on using more and more of our energy dollars out of state. If we spend money in-state on energy, we are creating jobs, jobs that cannot be outsourced, and jobs that pay well. That's what this bill does.
And my response to that would be that we need a long-term view, and society looks at this as a long-term view, and it could be some of the other options you mentioned are long-term views. I'm excited about things like Lockheed Martin is working on a power plant that is the size of a minivan that literally will put out 100 megawatts of power using atomic fusion, not fission, no waste, no issues. We need a bridge to get us to the future, but relative to, where doing it from a government perspective doesn't work that way in the real world.
Republican Bob Culp and Democrat Katrina Shankland pledged to work together on energy issues in the assembly. Climate change is affecting lakes not just in north central Wisconsin, but all over the world. The Trout Lake Station north of Minocqua is continuing a tradition of pioneering research by forming a network of scientists to study lake ecology around the globe.
We're here.
It's media day at the Trout Lake Research Station. Director Tim Kratz points to a map showing the 7,000 lakes in the region.
It's not an accident that the Trout Lake Station is where it is.
90 years ago, researchers here pioneered the scientific scientific study of lake ecology. Kraut says the studies continue with sophisticated new equipment.
Instruments out on platforms on lakes, very high-frequency measurements, measurements taken every few minutes.
In 2004, Kraut flew to Taiwan to meet two researchers interested in the work at Trout Lake. That initial meeting led to a global network of 400 scientists sharing data collected from lakes in 40 different countries.
Canada, Brazil, China, Japan, England, Germany, Poland, Switzerland, Sweden, Finland.
It's called GLEON, which stands for Global Lakes Ecological Observatory Network. Its scientists work across cultures, sharing data on water temperature, dissolved oxygen, algae pigments, and weather.
Scientists, no matter the culture, are very interested in collaborating with their colleagues. We're very interested in how climate change is affecting lakes all over the world.
Tim Kraut says the new global network could help protect the world's increasingly threatened freshwater resources.
That's the goal, try to keep the lakes healthy, to try to understand what makes lakes tick.
Continuing a 90-year history of pioneering work. At the UW Trout Lake Research Station, I'm Glenn Mobert for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Tim Kraut joined other Trout Lake researchers in a panel discussion that I moderated this past summer in Stevens Point at the annual Lakes Partnership Convention. It was the topic of a Route 51 show and a story for the Wisconsin Public Radio Network.
Really big trophy walleyes. Now they've lost their primary forage.
John Lyons, Fisheries Research Supervisor for the DNR, conducts a workshop on the effects of climate change on Cisco, a whitefish that can only survive in cold, oxygen-rich water.
If we have sort of the maximum amount of warming that's being projected, we'll lose on the order of 70% of our Cisco lakes by mid-century.
And if Cisco disappear from 70% of the lakes they inhabit, Lyons wonders what will happen to the trophy-sized walleyes and muskies that eat them.
We think it will potentially limit the large size, the availability of the real trophy fish. You know, they'll max out at a much smaller size than most trophy anglers are looking for.
John Lyons says we need more research to determine how the warming climate and the disappearing Cisco will affect Wisconsin's game fish. But Mary Plattner, a homeowner on Moon Lake in Vilas County, says she's already seen enough.
We have lost 20 feet of shoreline in Moon Lake in the 20 years we've lived there.
Plattner says climate change is affecting water levels at lakes all across the North Woods.
Big St. Germain, they had to go look at 40 feet of mud in order to get their boats out in the lake, and they couldn't. So we had resorts failing. We've got disappointed homeowners. Climate change is really, really affecting us.
The Wisconsin Lakes Partnership Convention is now in its 36th year. The mingling of scientists and citizens is organized by UW Extension, the DNR, and Wisconsin Lakes, a nonprofit organization. In Stevens Point, I'm Glenn Mobert for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Threats to our lakes and our groundwater have become flashpoints, particularly in the Golden Sands region of central Wisconsin, which has seen opposition to high-capacity wells and large-scale farms known as CAFOs, concentrated animal feeding operations. We attended a public hearing in Adams for Burr Oak Heifers, where citizens expressed concern about the level of nitrates in groundwater. The voices you'll hear are Brittany Clausen of Coloma, Frank Grebe of Friendship, and Andrew Craig of the DNR.
Do your job, or someone else eventually will.
This is our groundwater. This is my groundwater. It belongs to me, not them.
We are a state agency, and we implement the rules that the legislature passes.
Somebody needs to be talking to get these laws changed to protect our groundwater.
They have no control over what's coming into their site. That's why it's set at a higher standard than 10 milligrams per liter. The background is 28 milligrams per liter. They can't exceed background. That would be 28.
So you're saying that they can't essentially add any pollution?
Correct.
One of Wisconsin's leading environmental voices, Bill Berry, published a book called Banning DDT about the influence of our state's activists on the environmental movement in the 60s. Berry was a guest on Route 51, where he recalled seeing the trucks spraying for DDT as a child growing up in his Fox Valley neighborhood.
It was kind of an eerie scene, really. The yellow lights would be flashing, and there would be a guy on a portable PA system telling you to go inside, and thousands of birds had congregated in these trees, making the most god-awful noise I think I'd heard in my life. It sounded like fear to me, I think reacting to the acute poisoning because of the DDT spray. Michigan banned it first, Wisconsin followed. Almost unanimously, by the time it got to the legislature, it was approved in both houses. I think it's an important story to remind citizens right now that even though you may not have a lot of money or a lot of influence, you can make a difference. I think it would help young people sort of not be agnostic about the future of this country.
Bill Berry's book is called Banning DDT, How Citizen Activists in Wisconsin Led the Way. Thankfully, we don't use DDT anymore, but some Northwoods residents may have had second opinions after a big snow melt, a quick warm-up, and heavy rains led to a ferocious outbreak of mosquitoes early this summer. Ed Hammer is an outfitter south of Tomahawk.
Mosquitoes are the bane of my existence right now. They're just about ready to carry me and my partner away. Got two dogs. One dog doesn't even want to go outside. The other dog, he doesn't care, but he's bit up all over. The belly's just red.
The swarms of mosquitoes were joined by swarms of black flies this summer, which were so ferocious that they kept loons from sitting on their eggs. Walter Piper has been studying the birds in northern Wisconsin for years.
It's horrendous to watch. The flies simply feed at will on the loons' heads, and a loon that has been incubating, you can see their feathers are all ruffled from the welts that they've gotten from the black flies feeding mercilessly on them. So it's an ugly sight.
The loons would try again with better success later in the summer when the flies had abated. Marge Gibson, a wildlife rehabilitator from Antigo, has been taking care of injured loons, eagles, raptors, and owls for decades, as we found out when she made an appearance with one of her feathered friends on Route 51. So Marge right now is, she's opened up his enclosure, and she's opening up his door, and she's reaching inside, picking the owl up by its long, yellow, sharp talons. And the owl is ruffling its feathers.
Let's go. Here you go.
Stretching its wings.
Can
she's,
you hoot for me?
She's got the owl on her hand. She is not wearing a protective glove.
Well, thank you. Can you hoot for us some more? What a guy you are.
And you can see the tufts of feathers on the top of its head, which is the horns of the great horned owl.
Right, the feather tufts. So that is the part that they can put up and down at will. And if you'll notice, as he's sitting on my hand, he's not grasping at all. This is his choice, of course.
He's trying to fly,
he's
however.
He's fly off. I think he decided that that your microphones make a really nice perch. So.
Marge Gibson has received national renown for her work rehabilitating injured birds. A Wausau educator has received national renown for his work as a choir director, teacher, and most recently a show producer. The Wausau West Pop Concert has been a hit this week on Wisconsin Public Television. Music director Phil Book joined us on Route 51 after he announced his retirement, and we asked him about the religious music controversy he was involved in last fall.
We're having to have our music approved by administrators who aren't qualified because they're not trained musically. We are the hired professionals. We are the ones that the district has employed and has to trust us from our professional perspective.
But aren't they required by virtue of the law to have a balanced program of music from different traditions?
And that's exactly correct. Balance is key. And there's where the miscommunication was. In the past 5 years, in our programs at the Grand Theater, there have been a total of 71 secular songs sung at those performances, and there have been a total of 67 sacred songs. So the big issue was balance. Well, people who are talking about balance didn't really understand what the balance is, and so the records are there, 71 to 67. In my estimation, that's a pretty good balance.
Did you ever think there would be an auditorium with more than 700 people, virtually all of them angry with the school board, voicing their opposition to the religious music policy?
No, I never thought ever anything like that would transpire. I was deeply humbled, honored by that response from this community.
We lost many significant people in 2014. Lane Ware, who guided much of the progress and development in central Wisconsin. Woody Woodruff, the man known as Mr. Minocqua. Stephen Wright, the former pastor at Wausau's First Presbyterian Church, who worked tirelessly on the Christian cause of eradicating poverty and who died in a car accident. Arnie Solly, a former biology professor and musician who worked to preserve Finnish culture, and Sid Kyler, the legendary trumpeter, bandleader, artist, and broadcaster who passed away in July at the age of 87. Even well into his 80s, Sid Kyler still had it, belting out trumpet licks before more than 1,000 people at the jazz festival that bears his name. Clarinetist Louis Pratt played with Kyler for more than 60 years.
No, jazz was not a thing that was studied in schools or even encouraged at that time. We taught ourselves. We listened to records.
Kyler played his first gig in 1947. A few years later, he was hired at WSAU-TV, where he designed the Knight in Shining Armor Sir 7 logo still used by the station today. He worked with Central Wisconsin's first anchor man, Walter John Chilson.
It's not very often that a man can take a pen or oil and bring some humor to life with real expression. He was a good friend of mine, and I'm going to miss him.
Sid Kyler loved to paint, and he loved Dixieland jazz. He reflected on his career in a Wisconsin Public Radio interview.
For over the 60-plus years, the music business has been an enjoyable experience. At least 95% of the gigs have been great. We have performed for weddings, funerals, birthdays, conventions, dedications, private parties, bar mitzvahs, country clubs, church services, beer gardens, anniversaries, dance clubs, fundraisers, jam sessions, Christmas parties, proms, and Mardi Gras celebrations, as the beat goes on.
Sid Kyler was 87 years old. His band will perform a tribute at next weekend's Sid Kyler River Valley Jazz Festival in Wausau. I'm Glenn Mobert for Wisconsin Public Radio News. And on Route 51, some of the surviving members of the Sid Kyler Dixieland Jazz Band. That's Ray Kramer on piano, Louis Pratt on soprano sax, Roger Pickering on bass, yours truly on guitar, performing the Hoagy Carmichael classic, Georgia, live in our Wisconsin Public Radio studios in Wausau. Kramer on piano, Louis Pratt on soprano sax, Roger Pickering on bass. I'm Glenn Moberg, and this is the Route 51 year-end review show for 2014. When we return, we'll look at some of the economic and social justice issues we faced this past year. We'll profile some of the heroes of North Central Wisconsin, and we'll revisit live performances by Michael Perry and the South Beach Chamber Ensemble.
WPR is committed to unbiased journalism, interesting stories, and smart entertainment. Member support is the single biggest piece of our funding. It makes all the programs you enjoy on Wisconsin Public Radio possible. Thank you to our members.
Support also comes from Wausau's Woods and Art Museum, where 50 Greatest National Geographic Photographs features images and stories from the magazine's 120-year history, through February 22nd, lywam.org.
WPR is proud to sponsor the musical group Rusted Root, performing Thursday, January 8th at the Grand in Wausau. Rusted Root is known for their unique fusion of rock, acoustic, world, and other styles of music, with a strong percussion section that draws from African, Latin American, and Native American influences. For more information and a chance to win tickets, visit our website, wpr.org/central.
I'm Glenn Moberg, and this is the Route 51 year-end review show for 2014. The year began in brutal fashion with temperatures that reached 30 below zero in some parts of north-central Wisconsin, a situation that became life-threatening for the homeless and those who live in poverty.
This is the kind of cold that burns your nostrils and hurts your eyes. It's the kind of cold that shuts down schools and even retail businesses. And for the homeless here on the streets of Wausau, it can be deadly.
By the time I walked two blocks, I had ice in my mustache, eyelashes.
George Wood is a volunteer at the Catholic Charity Shelter, which takes care of about 20 homeless people every night.
We have to have something like this, otherwise we're going to be having a lot of homeless people deceased. I go up under the bridges and the parks and things like that. Sometimes I'll take hats, gloves, hand warmers, toe warmers.
Oh, he's freezing. Ow.
26-year-old Kevin Cochran came here from Florida and ended up on the street. He is not used to 25 below zero.
If we didn't have places like this, I'm pretty sure that most people would just freeze outside to death under the bridges. So, pretty important.
What puts you in a position where you have to use a shelter like this?
I can't find any work. Nobody wants to give anybody any interviews or chances.
How long have you been looking?
About 5 months now.
Harry, in his 80s, says he's too embarrassed about his situation to let us use his last name.
It would be wonderful if all of the churches would open their doors to the homeless and they're freezing outside. They could do that. And other public buildings, too, really. You know, they should open their doors up to them so they don't freeze to death.
At 11 a.m., Harry and Kevin are back on the frozen streets, waiting for the bus that takes them across town to the Salvation Army shelter, while the volunteers at Catholic Charities get ready for the next night shift. In Wausau, I'm Glenn Moberg for Wisconsin Public Radio News. A group of religious leaders this past fall held a series of summit meetings around the state, including one in Stevens Point, in which they tried to make the issue of poverty a defining one for the November elections. One of those religious leaders was Rabbi Dan Danson of Wausau.
Poverty programs have been favored more. Active poverty programs have been more part of Democratic platforms than they've been part of Republican platforms in the last couple of decades. So the question is, what makes this nonpartisan? Because we certainly respect the people vote different ways, they see different public policy options, and we for sure are not telling people to vote for this candidate or vote for that candidate. So I think what we're saying to people is that we know people on all sides of the political spectrum care about this issue. And you can see that Paul Ryan from Janesville has brought forward a platform addressing this on a national level.
Danson is a member of the faith-based social justice group Naomi, which saw a setback in November when Village of Weston residents voted to end public bus service in the community, something Danson and others saw as a moral imperative. The issue of poverty has also become wrapped up with efforts to raise the minimum wage. Wisconsin restaurant entrepreneur Craig Culver made news on Route 51 when he told us that he favored raising the minimum wage, but only for adults.
What I would like to see done is a two-tiered minimum wage. A youth wage, in other words, those 14, 15, 16, 17-year-olds, a wage for them, and that could be what it currently is, or $8 an hour or something like that, $8.50 an hour, and then a wage for those 18 and older or 19 and older, whichever. And that could be $10.10 an hour. That could be $12 an hour.
But others oppose what they see as government intervention in the free market. Republican U.S. Senator Ron Johnson, at a forum he led in Antigo, didn't back away from his earlier statements that Social Security, in his view, is similar to a criminal Ponzi scheme.
I, in a speech before I ever started running for Senate, called Social Security a Ponzi scheme, and I wasn't totally accurate, so let me correct the record, because a Ponzi scheme is illegal. When the government runs a Ponzi scheme, it's legal. So the correct term would be a legal Ponzi scheme. Now, I take no pleasure in saying that. It's sad, it's unfortunate, but it's true.
Wisconsin Senator Ron Johnson is up for re-election in 2016. For some, the partisan divide has become an impediment to progress. In Marshfield, Democrat Chris Jockheck and Republican Dan Wald joined forces on something they call the Civility Project to bring both sides together in a spirit of compromise.
The Democratic Party can do a forum with information from both sides, but that's not going to go over real big. It's important that both parties, the two major parties, co-sponsor an event so people can feel comfortable coming and getting information on both sides of an issue.
In the political realm, for people to act civilly, we as a people need to act civilly. We do have to come together and solve some of these issues. Well, if you do have that extreme political rancor, you're not going to do that.
Democrats and Republicans alike, leaders of both political parties, got together this year when the Dave Obey Civic Resource Center opened at his alma mater, UW-Marathon County. The event was attended by Republicans Tom Petri and Sean Duffy and Florida Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz.
His effectiveness was legendary, and it was a thing of beauty to watch. To see Dave in action, to see him, even in his curmudgeonly way, to reach across the aisle and build the relationships that you knew were the key to actually getting things done.
When I was on this campus, we didn't have Medicare. We didn't have Medicaid. We didn't have the Clean Air Act. We didn't have public broadcasting. It's a mighty changed country. We didn't have a civil rights bill or a voting rights bill. And all of those things came to pass because people gave a damn and they worked hard.
The issue of voting rights also motivated 87-year-old Ruth L. Frank of Brokaw, who won at least a temporary victory when the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Wisconsin's attempt to implement the voter ID law before the November election. Frank doesn't have a birth certificate, and she doesn't intend to get one.
I wouldn't pay up to $200 to get a new birth certificate. See, I would have been probably, what, 84 when I started this mess? They think I've touched all 50 states, but I know I've touched all the corners of the U.S. because I've had people call me from Florida, I've had people from Washington, people from Pennsylvania.
Ruth L. Frank served for many years in local politics in her hometown of Brokaw, a village that is going through very tough times because of the shutdown of the paper mill it was built around more than a century ago. We took an in-depth look at what it means to be unemployed in a mill town. On this cold February morning, Wausau Paper's old Brokaw Mill stands like a silent sentinel over this old company town. The once bustling streets are empty. 450 people lost their jobs here, leaving the old mill and the town that was built around it hollow, empty shells of what used to be.
Folks that lived in Brokaw, whose families worked at the mill, it's like having your knees cut out from underneath you.
2 years ago, Jill Goffin was a supervisor at Brokaw when the axe fell. 6 years ago, she was one of 500 people who were fired at the Domtar Mill in Port Edwards.
You sit and think to yourself, I cannot believe that this is happening again. Papermaking is a very prideful industry. Generations come through, grandfathers and fathers and sons and daughters. When all that ends, what do you do now?
The old mills are victims of new realities both here and abroad, according to Dave Ekman, economic development specialist at UW-Stevens Point.
There's some unfair trade practices with the Chinese flooding the market. Printed materials are being replaced with digital formats.
Ekman says companies have been forced to close some mills and retool the others for a new market in technical paper products.
Paper's not dead. It's changing. The companies here are competing in a global economy, and they're doing their best.
Ekman says for the workers, the change has not been easy.
They're not likely going to find those types of wages and benefits that they found in the paper mill. There has to be some acceptance to that, and that's a hard thing to overcome.
Since 1987, more than 3,900 good-paying jobs have been lost because of mill closures in the Wisconsin Valley. Many joined the ranks of the long-term unemployed.
Thank you for calling the Job Center. This is Laura.
But some are coming back to the job market. 15 miles south of Brokaw, the Wausau Job Center is humming with people looking for work. Cindy Kiesling is the executive director of the Labor Education and Training Center.
Why did this happen to me? What did we do to make this happen? 9 times out of 10, it was nothing those individuals did. Those folks went to work right out of high school.
In Brokaw, 68% of the mill workers had only a high school degree or even less. Kiesling says teaching them new skills is essential and challenging.
People are hesitant about retraining. It can be overwhelming. How am I going to pay my bills?
Jill Goffin says it's not easy to go back to school. When she got fired the first time at Port Edwards, she had to sacrifice everything to get her degree.
I was a homeowner at the time and had to make some tough decisions and ended up selling my house and liquidating 75% of my assets.
But that degree landed her a job at the Brokaw Mill. And the day after Brokaw shut down, that degree also landed Jill Goffin her current job as a supervisor at the Neenah Paper Mill.
There wasn't anything that was going to stop me. I knew that the short-term impacts were going to be outweighed by what I was going to gain long-term by having my degree completed.
Whether it's a degree from a four-year school or a crash course at a technical college, Cindy Kiesling and Dave Ekman agree that education is the way out.
Make efforts to educate yourself on new technologies because technology continues to move forward. And it will leave you behind.
Most dislocated workers are excellent students. Very focused, very determined, very motivated.
While Brokaw and other communities are reeling because of the changes in the old paper industry, there is hope for the unemployed if they take the steps to retrain for the new economy. In Brokaw, I'm Glenn Moberg for Wisconsin Public Radio News. There was also a shock to the regional economy a few miles north of Brokaw in Wausau when J.C. Penney, a fixture in the city's downtown for many years, announced it was moving out of the mall. The news shocked downtown businessman Mark Hadley and shoppers like Ginger Berry of Medford and Kent Hubbard of Wausau.
It's quite a shock, actually. As a kid coming here to the mall, like my mom would always take me to J.C. Penney's to get new school clothing, and now it's not going to be there.
We're out of town. We live over by Medford, and when we come this way, I always shop Penney's. I guess we'll just have to go to Eau Claire or someplace else.
The Wausau Center Mall was open the day my twins were born, and it's kind of meant a lot to me. It's meant a heck of a lot to this community, and I don't know who they're going to bring in. I sure in the heck hope we don't lose any other anchor.
There was another controversy in Wausau this year over a public art project on the western edge of the community. A series of heron sculptures on the Highway 52 Stewart Avenue entrance to the city. Opinions varied greatly about what became known as the Rusty Birds.
Well, the first time I saw them, I was just stunned because I thought they were real. The light was kind of low, and then I looked, and my gosh, they're just beautiful. They're just beautiful.
In our family, we call them the goosed geese. When I drive by them, I just say, why are they there? I mean, what's the significance? What's the meaning of those birds?
Wausau residents Ed Merrick and Lenore Roosh. Irregularities in the bidding process for the bird sculptures, combined with problems with the Thomas Street expansion and conflicts among City Hall staffers, led this past year to a call to change Wausau's form of government from strong mayor to city administrator. But there was positive economic news for some regional economies. Voters in the village of Amherst decided to keep the community's iconic mill pond, and the roar of Harleys once again filled the air for the Fall Ride and Tomahawk. Some called that the sound of money.
The sound of money? Yeah, the rumble of the bike.
It's also the sound of fun and entertainment and a good camaraderie of everyone that's on two wheels.
Further north, a Wisconsin institution, Big Top Chautauqua, got a new Big Top. We talked to Phil Anich and Michael Perry of Tent Show Radio about the tent and what it's like to perform there on Route 51.
The tent, there is really something special about it. It is so much like a ship, seemingly acres of canvas that are in the air that are held down by ropes and poles. When the wind is nailing it, when the rain is coming down so hard that you can barely hear yourself think, it's really quite an adventure.
Seeing the show under canvas is absolutely special. I always say that that place is, it's supposed to, I think, hold 900, but it makes them feel like a cozy dozen. And the sound and of the audience and the music coming off that canvas, there's just this gentleness to it.
And Michael Perry, Phil Anich, and I sat down and jammed live on the air on that Route 51 show. I got to sit in with Michael Perry on one of his classic compositions after Waymore's Blues. I'm Glenn Moberg. You're listening to the Route 51 Year-End Review Show for 2014. Michael Perry.
You want me to let one rip here?
Yeah, let's do Waymore Blues.
All right, we'll see what we can do. I'll waller through it.
Roll out of bed this morning, gave myself the evil eye. I roll out of bed this morning, gave myself the evil eye. You're a whole lot of too much woman, I'm just another guy. Well, it sure is hot for August, hotter than you thought it'd be. It sure is hot for August, hotter than you dreamed it'd be. Yeah, you best put some distance between you and me. Well, I bet you'd like to know I came to be this way.
Yeah, I bet you'd love to know. I came to be this way. That's one part blame my mama, two parts blame the man who got away. Well, a man on the television says an angel has got my back, you know. That old man on the television says an angel has got my back right. Last time I seen that angel, well, he was off the pace and he was fading fast. That's one part blame my mama, two parts blame the man who got away. That's one part blame my mama, two parts blame the man who got away. That's one part blame my mama, two parts blame the man who got away. Got away, got away, got away.
Michael Perry.
Supporters of Wisconsin Public Radio include the Edward J. Okray Foundation, Bernie's Rock Shop, and St. Mary's University Winona. Your business can join our ever-growing list of contributors. More information at wpr.org/sponsor. Support also comes from Wausau's River District, a classic American downtown with more than 70 locally owned businesses for shopping, dining, and lodging. Upstream from the ordinary. WausauRiverDistrict.com.
Winter in north central Wisconsin. Brisk, quiet, majestic. Whether skiing Granite Peak, ice fishing Lake Tomahawk, cross-country skiing at Winter Park, snowshoeing in Adams County, or ice skating around town. Get out and enjoy winter's magic. And while you're at it, don't forget to take your radio companion along for the ride. Wisconsin Public Radio.
I'm Glenn Moberg, and this is the Route 51 Year-End Review Show for 2014. We're going to look now at some of the heroes we talked with this past year, including Adrian Knops, a man with roots in northern Wisconsin who survived a harrowing week in the Alaskan wilderness on a bear hunting trip after a mishap killed his partner and friend. Knops found himself clinging to a tree, surrounded by water in gale-force winds, with inadequate clothing and only four granola bars.
Saturday afternoon especially, the winds got noticeably stronger. I mean, if the first days were 75, these winds are 100 plus. And when I was behind the fallen tree, you know, you can get some shelter from the wind. But during the high tides, you know, you got to get out of there because the tides came up around that tree later in the week about 4 to 5 feet. So I couldn't stay down on the ground. And if I fell asleep, my greatest fear was the tides. When they come in, if you're in the water and the water comes around you, even if I woke up and jumped up on the tree, I would be drenched with 40-degree water. And a couple of times of that, you know, you'd be dead. So I wouldn't let myself sleep.
Adrian Knops credits his faith with keeping him alive for that week in the Alaskan wilderness. We spent an hour on Route 51 with another heroic figure, women's basketball pioneer Pat McKenzie Lachaud, who appeared at UW-Stevens Point this past March as the school hosted the NCAA Division III Women's Basketball Championships. McKenzie Lachaud was there to honor Title IX, the groundbreaking law that stopped discrimination against women in sports more than 50 years ago.
I have been blessed in my life to have had the opportunity to play beside African-American teammates, teammates that were homosexual, teammates that were French, teammates that were German, and teammates from all different economic levels. And the fact that when you are on a team together, you don't look anymore at this person's white, this person's black, this person's French, this person's German. You look at them as individuals, and those people are your teammates, and you got their back.
Pat McKenzie Lachaud is the author of Home Sweet Hardwood, a Title IX trailblazer breaks barriers through basketball. The legacy of discrimination and the continuing racial divide in America was the subject of a Route 51 show that featured two African-American men with roots in central Wisconsin, educator Daryl Mayfield and Joe Johnson, the author of Nobody, Perseverance of a Sharecropper's Son. Johnson recalled a lynching he experienced growing up in segregated Mississippi.
He was dating an interracial girl. A mulatto, as they was called, and still are called. And some of the white guys there, you know, they wanted her. And he refused to give her up. So, make the long story short, he was killed for that reason. He was castrated and drugged behind a car, you know, and to his parents' home. And they blew the car home and awakened their parents, and then they drove off. Now, then people said to me, well, how can you not hate someone like that?
Joe said, a mulatto. Now, that term was an official term used by the Confederacy to basically distinguish people of African ancestry or people of African and European ancestry.
That was for the slave trade, right? Mulattoes could be sold at a higher price.
Mulattoes could be sold at a higher price. There is no such thing. But yet we continue in the belief that there is, and so the economic, the political institutions, the educational institutions reflect what we really believe about the other, people who are not like us.
Central Wisconsin educator Daryl Mayfield and Joe Johnson, author of Nobody, Perseverance of a Sharecropper's Son. We were honored to spend an hour with a true American hero in November on Route 51, Joe Murchison, one of the famed Triple Nickels, a pioneering black paratrooper who helped integrate the U.S. Army back in the 40s. Joe Murchison is one of the last surviving members of the 555th Parachute Infantry Battalion, better known as the Triple Nickels. He told hundreds of students in Edgar how his unit integrated the Army before President Truman made it official.
Some of them were shocked. They had never heard of a situation where people could not go into the front end of a restaurant and have a meal or drink from a particular water fountain.
Murchison had to ride in the back of the bus and couldn't dine with white soldiers, even as he trained alongside them.
We ran 10 miles before breakfast. We made 25-mile forced marches at night.
Joe Murchison wears a medallion of three buffalo nickels, standing for the Triple Nickels and referring back to the Buffalo Soldiers of the 19th century.
The Buffalo Soldiers were given the name Buffalo Soldiers because the Indians said they had hair like the hide of a buffalo. That was a compliment.
Murchison says one of the greatest moments of his life was seeing a black man elected commander-in-chief. He says he's bitter about the way President Obama has been treated.
I'm going to make a statement. It's racism. He's being treated like a black man. That's why he has so much problem. I think right now that this country feels that it should be controlled by only old white men.
But Murchison doesn't want you to call him an African-American.
I am all American. African-American sets me out into a different category altogether.
Joe Murchison was in central Wisconsin through the student lecture series, A Walk in Their Shoes. In Wausau, I'm Glenn Moberg for Wisconsin Public Radio News. A central Wisconsin World War II veteran who fought in General Patton's army at the Battle of the Bulge, John Rainier of Stevens Point, published his memoirs this year, Denying the Deniers, A Soldier's Intersection with the Holocaust. Rainier remembers vividly what he saw when he liberated the Nazi concentration camps in Europe.
Oh, the orders were terrible. This was April 12th, 1945, a beautiful spring day, and the grounds were full of corpses. But they had these people come out of the barracks and machine gunned them, and then they had two mass graves quite filled, but there are still bodies scattered all over the grounds. It was the most shocking thing we could ever imagine. Eisenhower's comment when they opened the body shed, he said, "This is the damnedest thing I've seen in all my life." Anyone had cameras was encouraged to take all the pictures you could because I want the world to know what we're seeing.
John Rainier, who says he published his memoirs denying the deniers because of the growing number of people who say the Holocaust never happened. A former Central Wisconsin educator is working to help the innocent victims of another war, Vietnam, which left hundreds of thousands of unexploded bombs littering the Laotian countryside. Jim Harris, the former principal of Weston Elementary School, became involved with the problems of Laos because of his Hmong students.
Every one of the little cluster bomblets has 300 steel ball bearings. And when a load of 670 go off, they cut everything over 3 football fields to ribbons. There were 4 million bombs that size dropped on Laos during the war, and that was a country of 3 million people. If you face a problem that seems too big to change, well, we can't change the world, but we can change one person's world.
Jim Harris founded a nonprofit called We Help War Victims. An unusual exhibit honoring the soldiers of the Vietnam War came to the Woodson History Center in Wausau, displaying actual graffiti drawn by the soldiers of that war. We saw the graffiti and the soldiers who drew it.
The ship was not.
The exhibit was brought to Wausau's Woodson History Center by Art Beltrone, a military artifacts expert who stumbled upon it while touring a mothballed troop ship, the General Nelson M. Walker.
It blew me away. It was like walking into a time capsule. Everything was still in place, the bunks, the pillows, the sheets, and on the underside of the canvases were messages.
Messages from almost 60 years ago, each scrawled in felt-tip pen on the bottom of a narrow sleeping canvas by a soldier in the bunk below. Beltrone says the authors were working-class kids.
They were young kids. They were young Americans. Most of them were 18, 19.
The graffiti is startling. There are profane images of the late 60s, whiskey bottles, psychedelic drugs, and naked women with bouffant hair. But there's also a complete sonnet by Shakespeare, the lyrics of the anti-war song Universal Soldier, sardonic jokes about death in combat, and appeals to patriotism. There's even a map of Stevens Point drawn by a homesick soldier.
Graffiti, when it's written, is the most honest expression of that person when he writes it.
Art Beltrone was able to save that graffiti and put it into a traveling exhibit called Marking Time. An exhibit viewed by dozens of men from the 2nd Squadron 1st Armored Cavalry, who all sailed to Vietnam on the Walker and who just happened to be holding a reunion in Wisconsin.
The Walker, for all her dents and peeling paint, has always made a bunch of us feel like she was more of a mother.
Dennis Scott may love the Walker and the men who served on it, but he didn't love Vietnam.
The rains of the monsoons and the heat of the non-monsoons and cooking boa constrictors and rotten buffalo.
The graffiti images were published in the American Legion magazine, which was delivered to the Kansas home of Tom and Gay Ann Fay.
I didn't even remember doing it. I evidently let out
a giant shout.
Gay Ann was in the kitchen, so I really scared her.
Tom Fay saw the heart he had drawn with their names and the fateful date of their wedding, August 27th, 1966.
I got my draft notice August 26th at our rehearsal dinner. We were getting married the next day.
I was 22. His dad handed him the letter with a chuckle. Ha, ha, ha.
Tom Fay had forgotten the heart he drew, but he remembers the General Walker.
Hot. Stinky. So bloody hot. Water just ran off of you.
And he remembers what happened when he got to Vietnam.
Brand new lieutenant. Had never driven a track before, and he wanted to drive it. He rolled it off the mountain, broke my back.
Jim Hardy was on the Walker in 1967 when it ran into Typhoon Violet, packing 145 mile per hour winds.
The waves were 90 foot up about and 90 foot down, so the ship would free fall 180 feet and slam onto the ocean and just vibrate like a gigantic sledgehammer hit it and just shake.
Hardy says the ship's restroom was filled with men on their knees. Some of them were even praying.
Praying to get to Vietnam. I heard troops say, please God, get me to Vietnam. I got a rifle and I got a chance.
But Jim Hardy says he too loved that ship.
It took care of us. It got us there. It was like an old friend. It wasn't a piece of metal.
Looking at the graffiti, Tom Fay and Dennis Scott mostly remember the men who wrote it.
The book, The Band of Brothers. I mean, that's what we are. We're closer than family.
We're friends, the best of friends. We love each other.
And they still love the General Nelson M. Walker. In Wausau, I'm Glenn Mobert for Wisconsin Public Radio News. Well, as always this year, we're going to end things with a performance by the South Beach Chamber Ensemble.
The first one is La Comparsita, and you probably don't know the name, but you've heard this tango many, many times.
That's Wausau native Michael Andrews on cello. You are also listening to Sarah Schreffler and UW Stevens Point's Oscar Soler on violin, Kenneth Martinson on viola, and Cindy Blandino on double bass. I'm Glenn Moberg. Thanks to the people who made it happen this year, our executive producer Rick Ryer, our on-air producer Jane Ritger, thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme, live music today from Paul Filipowicz, the Sid Kyler Dixieland Jazz Band, Michael Perry, and the South Beach Chamber Ensemble. Remember to follow us on Facebook. If you missed part of the show, you can hear it again in its entirety Friday night at 7 on WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau. Thanks for riding along with us today. Forward, as we say in Wisconsin, and until next week, we're heading out of town.